Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In conjunction with its exhibition, Weaving History into Art, Gilcrease Museum presents contemporary artist Gina Adams in a virtual artist talk tomorrow afternoon. Adams, a descendant of both indigenous Ojibwes and colonial Americans, sews history into art with her Broken Treaty quilt series. Adams sews calico multicolored text from historic treaties between U.S. and British governments and American indigenous tribes onto antique quilts, many of them from the same region and the same age as the treaties themselves. The multicolored letters appear to fade in and out of view, in that way imitating the promises made in the text. The quilts invite viewers in and encourage them to understand better a complicated history between colonial Americans and Native peoples. Adams is currently a professor at the Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver, British Columbia, and has been a Smithsonian Fellow, and her work is a part of the collections of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the Peabody Essex Museum, and the Museum of Contemporary Native Arts in Santa Fe, among others. You can learn more about her artist talk tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock in a virtual talk sponsored by Gilcrease Museum at gilcrease.org. Gina Adams, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Buju Anin, Gina Adams, Indigenous, Vancouver, British Columbia, Ndonjaba, Mingezi, and Dudum. Thank you so much. I come to you from the Indigenous territories that are unceded of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh today.
All right. Well, your Broken Treaty quilt series combines craft with messaging to create work that is simultaneously inviting to viewers, but also challenging. How did this series come about?
So it came about by doing research. Initially, when I was in graduate school at the University of Kansas, I was in my second year, and I was researching the Indian Wars newspapers of the West. And I'm a printmaker. My undergrad from Maine College of Art was printmaking, painting, and curatorial studies. And I was looking at the letterpress font that was used to create the newspapers, and I found that it was dowdy old style. I looked into Word, Microsoft Word, because I was just curious, does it still exist? Sure enough, it did, but I had to take it into Illustrator and blow it up to be about 4.5-inch letters. Initially, this was going to become calico letters, hand-cut. It was a basketball assimilation banner project for a video I wanted to do at Haskell Indian Nations University, which is also in Lawrence, Kansas, near KU. So I did that project in May of 2013. Calico fabric is very important because it connects to the history of the early Americas, and it was the first mill commodity for export to other countries for monetary gain to the United States. Another reason why calico fabric is so important is because it's directly tied to slavery, with its use of cotton from the South.
Right.
So the connections to history tie in there. I created the 7 basketball banners after I graduated while I was at a residency in Key West, Florida. In August of that summer of 2013, I collected an antique quilt with my mother at a flea market in Massachusetts. And I dreamt that night that I needed to cut an entire treaty and stitch it onto this antique quilt. So it literally came from my dreams, but my Anishinaabe Ojibwemoan ancestors are very tied and connected to our dreams, mm-hmm. and with the medicine that can come from our dreams. So I'm very directed intuitively that way. Well, and so the first one took me almost a year. And then I received my first solo show in the fall of 2014, opening January of 2015 at the Nerman Museum of Contemporary Art, and they wanted 7 for that exhibition. So I had to hire assistants to fairly quickly help me cut 6 more Broken Treaty quilts so that I could then create them.
I'm assuming you had very little background with stitching and the whole process that you involved with prior to this, or had you been involved?
Yes. I'm a 4th generation quilt maker.
Okay.
My first color theory lessons were at 12 to 14 years old with my aunt, who's made about 350 quilts.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother is a seamstress, dressmaker. My grandmother is a quilt maker, and there's my great-grandmother as well.
So sewing was very much a big part of your background, and quilt making.
Yeah, well, sewing in general was everything. Like, I grew up learning how to sew with a needle and thread, sitting underneath my mother while she was sewing on her machine and passing me scraps of fabric and thread.
So you said this came to you in a dream. Tell us about the process of using quilts as a way to convey meaning and message. I'm interested in that, using that material.
So the quilt itself, the quilts are antique, and I want them to be, when I'm searching for these quilts, I want them to be about 150 years old, or about the same time. Some of them are much older. Some of them have been pre-Civil War. I want them, the quilts, to be created around the same time as the treaties themselves. I'm also looking for patterns of geographic locations. So, for instance, right now I'm working with the Field Museum in Chicago and creating two Treaty of Chicago's, 1821 and 1837. And previously I was searching for quilts from the upper Midwest and the Chicago region, Illinois region, and I do have two that are really beautiful that I'm using for that project. So the other part about the quilt that is really important is a lot of my work has always had this thread of being unidentified. The unidentified is because indigenous peoples of North America and internationally are often not, they're in collections because the colonization like collected these objects of belonging, but they're not identified to who their culture, their maker.
Right.
Sometimes their materials are noted, but they're often marked unidentified.
True. So the maker of the object is never mentioned. I mean, you have to go to the mid-20th century, I think, before you see functional objects. And I'm thinking of like Maria Martinez maybe a first person who's actually mentioned as the maker of the object.
Yeah, and there were many early contemporary Native curators. And one of my mentors, George Longfish, he was at the, he went to the School of the Art Institute for his undergrad and graduate degree, and then he was at UC Davis, and he ran a Native American art and scholar program, but he was also the director of the George Gorman Museum there. And he and many others, along with Jean Quictusee Smith, really championed artists, indigenous artists, to be named and to have recognition in the contemporary art world. But the problem ties way back to the early museums. And even, I would say, the Smithsonian, the way they sent people out to just collect objects of belonging. And that so many were collected, but were not notated or documented or named.
Yeah, it just goes to a culture as opposed to,
So these quilts are very much tied to that, even though they were made by colonial Americans. And I see them as part of the movement westward, because so many of them I have found in the central states. They are unidentified. They're worn. They were objects of belonging. They may have stayed in families for generations, and then somehow they ended up in the hands of an antique dealer, or in a flea market, like the first one I found. But often the maker is not known.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it as creating a balance of the colonizer, the colonial America, and of indigenous America.
Right. It's the same process. It belonged to an individual. That meaning attached to it is lost now of who, what family, what person created it. Yeah.
Right.
Your talk here at Gilcrease will be in conjunction with the Shan Goshorn exhibition, where she is weaving basketry, which has, again, political messages of indigenous culture weaving into what becomes contemporary artworks. And she did it with basketry, and it came after a decade of more of confronting viewers with more traditional art genres with messages about appropriation of Indian culture. And she said, you know, when she switched to basketry, all of a sudden basketry invited viewers in to be more open to the message. Do you think quilting offers the same sort of invitation to viewers about the message you're conveying with the Broken Treaties quilts?
Absolutely. They're an object of comfort. They're an object of belonging. They're not in your face political to start. People see them as loving objects. They approach them as they're viewing the Broken Treaty quilt. They come to an understanding that it's something greater. It has a deeper meaning. And then they start to open up and understand that there's something they maybe don't know or they weren't taught. And what I've seen is that a shift happens, and they've had this physical shift, this visual shift, and they start to open up and want to learn more about the history of, you know, North America and the United States. I'm in Canada now, and Canada has the very same history of assimilation practices. And, you know, education, K-12 education is mandated by the U.S. government on what can be taught. And these truthful histories, these painful histories, are left out.
True. I mean, in your case, you're doing treaties going back to the early, well, maybe the late 18th century through all the 19th century. Most of these treaties, unless you're a part of the indigenous people that it regarded, most people don't know those names. The Treaty, the Three Medicine Lodge Treaty, the Treaty of the Six Nations, the Passamaquoddy Treaty, the Treaty of Fort Laramie. These are unknown today. So when viewers see this beautiful quilt, say the Treaty of Fort Laramie, which has the treaty on one side, which is in all sorts of calico colors and letters, lettering, beautiful sort of diamond design on the back. How do they view that message? How do they, what do they take in first?
I think first they take in the color and they take in the pattern. Often, you know, usually the quilts are hanging in the middle of the gallery, so they see one side or another. I find that they spend a lot of time, they'll see there's the back of the antique quilt, it's the front of the Broken Treaty quilt, and it's like the title page. It's important to know that I don't place all of the language of the treaty, because it wouldn't fit. So I'm choosing language from the treaty that is significant to know. And with each treaty that I work with, it's different. And so I find that viewers spend time then trying to read. They read the treaty on both sides. They're trying to distinguish and read it on also the back side, the colorful side, the side with the pattern. And they're really trying to read the language. And the way I've worked the color, and goes back to color theory in my training with Albers and Itten from Maine College of Art, and also my aunt, who taught me how to really choose a colorful, very impactful quilt top with colorful calico fabric. I want the letters to fade in and fade out and have this sensory simulation thing that happens, and almost like they disappear. They're hard to read. That's very purposeful, because these treaties themselves are, even though they were written, the earliest one I've done was the Treaty of Portsmouth, 1710, but now there's a new database online where I can find even older treaties that I have had a difficult time finding, because these treaties have not been kept in places to be easily discovered historically. Yeah.
Imagine that. So
that's been another issue. However, I see it as an opportunity, because I would say 35 to 50% of my practice is spent in research. I really prepare and try to make many, many discoveries along the way before I even start the work. So that you cannot entirely read, you know, one side of the treaty is purposeful. And I want the impact of it to just be color. And I want it to be read as art, similar to, say, a Jasper Johns flag painting. Mm-hmm. I want you just to see the image, but then I want you to take in the message.
My guest today is Gina Adams, a contemporary cross-discipline artist, a professor at Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver, British Columbia. She'll be discussing her Broken Treaty quilt series along with her other work Friday at 1 in a virtual artist talk in conjunction with Gilcrease Museum's Shan Goswarn's exhibition, Weaving History into Art. Shan used basketry to convey, again, broken promises, the horrible legacy of how European Americans treated indigenous populations in America. And Gina does the same with broken treaties and the quilts. And I really find one of the interesting things about the process that, again, you're putting portions of the treaties on these quilts, and it's some of the most important language, like in perpetuity, this land will belong to this tribe, or, you know, ceding important rights that as the letters fade in and out, you realize they're not really, those letters really don't, and the words don't mean much of anything and didn't mean much of anything in the long term of history.
Well, to the U.S. government, it was just about moving people out that the United States and the people moving westward were, I would say, inconvenienced by the fact that they were wanting to acquire something that they couldn't really have. And they were willing to take it by any means. The treaties themselves are, most of the time, there were interpreters and agents present to enforce the signers to sign. And the signers were coerced. They didn't really always understand. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of complicated history around why they signed or did not sign. But in most times, they didn't even understand the Native American people did not even understand because they did not speak the language. They didn't speak the English language, and they were forced to sign with their X mark. Hmm. And that part of it is really important to understand as well, because these people that were forced to sign lost so much, including boarding schools, because boarding schools were a direct result of treaties. And it was a condition of the treaty that the chiefs that signed the treaty were forced to send their children and their male sons to boarding school. So in the early history of First Carlisle Indian School, where my grandfather was sent, they were mostly children of signers of the treaties, and then other children that were also gathered up and forcibly taken.
And I understand that those stories your grandfather has told you has played an important role in your art over the years.
From an early age, again, through dream work, I spent most of my summers with my grandfather in Southern Maine. My grandfather left when he graduated, left Carlisle. He went into the Navy, and then he settled in Southern Maine and somehow acquired a 40-acre allotment. And I'm still trying to figure out that piece. Because the 40 acres, they were not wealthy. And he ended up in Southern Maine, and I would spend summers with him and my grandmother. And it was a 40-acre organic farm where everything they raised, they'd either sell or survived off the land. And I started having nightmares at age 5, like massacre dreams, like these. I would wake up screaming, and he would take me out for walks, and he would calm me down by talking to me in the Ojibwe language. So what he retained while a child from 7 on at Carlisle was the language of the plants and plant spirit medicine because of our Mittewing medicine connection through Ojibwa Moan culture. He retained that language. He also retained the names of his people. So, you know, he told me about Wabanaqua and who he was. He told me about Mishigishiguk. He told me about Minidowab. But he also told me about Charles Wright. And he told me Charles Wright was a very bad man and that I had to watch out for him in the back of his hands. I never understood this until in 2016 I was doing research in the Smithsonian Natural History Museum archive, the same archive that Shan Goshorn just a few years before had done her SARF fellowship. This Charles Wright was in a delegation photo. He was Wabanaqua's son. He was in the first group of children to be removed from White Earth Reservation from the treaty that was signed in 1867, of which I created the treaty with the Mississippi of the Chippewa, 1867 Broken Treaty Quilt. I created that while I was also in D.C. for my Smithsonian Fellowship. So from these times spent with my grandfather, what he gave me is what has continually opened up avenues of research. And I grew up in southern Maine where the stereotype of Native America was stronger than the existence of Native American indigenous peoples my whole life.
Explain that if you would.
So I grew up in a place where living history museums were really, really popular. You know, Plymouth Plantation was 2 hours from where I grew up. Of course, you know, Salem, the Salem Witch Museums and, you know, all the buildings and the Nathaniel Hawthorne building, the history with like Herman Melville and the writing of Moby Dick and the history of whaling and the early colonial Americas. I grew up with this living history museum called the Old York Historical Society. And every single semester, fall and spring, we would dress up as either pilgrims or some children would choose to dress up as little Indians, which I never did. And we would go and spend the day in these living history museums. And part of that learning would be learning about the Indian massacre that took place in the town where the Native Americans supposedly burned down like the village of York. But essentially, there was first a massacre that took place and also one of genocide by disease.
Right.
So the history is really, really, really complicated. And so I grew up, I remember early on being in second grade and sharing with my class some of my Ojibwa language. And my teacher got very angry. She said I was lying. And I essentially was given a few detentions.
Wow. And we think of this as being like 50 years ago or something, and it still happened even in your youth.
Right. I am 55. So that was... second grade, I think I was seven, right?
Right.
But yeah, it happened quite a bit. And there, you know, even there was this, on my Adam's side, I remember there, my grandfather started this trading post on my Adam's side. So my Adam's grandfather and my Ojibwa grandfather were best friends for 50 years. But my Ojibwa grandfather would often trade and be a guide for my Adam's grandfather. So I grew up having that kind of information too about how this friendship was formed between them. And it was a very great friendship of which, you know, my parents are of that union, you know, of that connection of their fathers being really good friends their whole lives.
Yeah. My guest today is Gina Adams, a contemporary multidisciplinary artist. She's a professor of Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver, British Columbia. She'll be discussing her Broken Treaty Quilt series this Friday at 1 at Gilcrease, but not at Gilcrease. It'll be a virtual presentation, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, you've made about, at least by my count, 35 of these quilts. Is this an enduring project? Are you going back further in history? What's going on with the series at this point?
So I have 16 in my studio right now, assembled or ready to be assembled. There are 367 broken treaties historically between the United States government and Native nations. There are more if you consider the French. The Treaty of Portsmouth was a British treaty declared to the Northern New England nations.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many more. It's my life's work. I'm not stopping anytime soon. My goal is to create a broken treaty quilt for all of them. Another thing I've just finished, and I say I mean we, because I actually have assistants that I hire who are near and dear to me, and I consider them to be family, who help cut letters. I have six letter cutting assistants. And one of them, who lives in Lawrence, Kansas, just helped me finish, spent this last almost a whole year cutting the American Indian Act. And that will actually be not a broken treaty quilt, but it will be about 8 to 10 quilts. And it will only be on one side because this is part of an installation film that will happen in 2022. So there's a lot of work happening. The broken treaty quilts are one facet of the work because I also do ceramics and some painting, but they are definitely what is most urgent.
Well, people will be able to see the process, and I guess some people will actually, you'll be doing letter cutting with some volunteers as well a part of this project, and we wish you great success with it. They're very striking pieces of art. They're objects that are inviting and challenging at the same time, that help inform people of a complicated and long history. Gina, it's my pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich. And thank you to everyone at the Gilcrease for inviting me in to do this virtual talk and open letter cutting session. Miigwech, Gigawalpim, and Minua.
Contemporary artist Gina Adams speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be discussing her Broken Treaty Quilt series tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock in a Gilcrease Museum virtual artist talk in conjunction with her Shan Goshorn exhibition, Weaving History into Art. She'll be speaking at 1. For information on how you can participate, visit gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.